Welcome to the Drug Review Podcast, nurturing knowledge of drugs and alcohol.
Today I'm joined by Stephen Rolnick. Stephen is Professor of Healthcare Communication at Cardiff University and is perhaps best known as one of the co-founders of Motivational Interviewing, which will probably be very familiar to people working in the substance misuse sector. The third edition of his book, Motivational Interviewing, Helping People Change, co-written with William Miller, was published last year. Welcome to the podcast, Stephen.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks for having me, man.
Thank you very much for coming along. I remember my first time I ever read the first edition of Motivation Interviewing. It really did change my practice and it really did change my outlook on working with people in the helping professions. So for me, it's a great honour and a privilege to have a little time with you to talk through some of the more recent developments with Motivation Interviewing. So thank you very much for agreeing to participate. So I guess if we start off with some of the people I would imagine who might be listening to this may not be familiar with motivational interviewing. Why don't we start off, if you wouldn't mind, with just a short summary of what MI actually is and perhaps what it's not?
Yeah, it's a form of counselling that was developed in the addictions field for helping people resolve uncertainty about change. It's a style in which you encourage the person to say why and how they might change rather than tell them how you think they might change. So that's it in one sentence, but it's not a wonder method, Matt. It's not something that's going to solve all problems. It's not something that's going to suit everybody and every setting or context or challenge. It's not something you do to or on people, but rather with them. And it's a rather quiet and gentle way of speaking about change that utilizes people's own internal resources and motivations to change. And it has listening at its center, which might well be something we talk a little bit more about.
We will definitely come on to that because I think, as we both know, it's absolutely crucial and critical to the success of motivational interviewing. How does it differ then, perhaps, from some of the other methodologies or some of the other styles which people use, things like cognitive behavioral therapy or brief solution focused therapy, some of the other talking approaches that some of the practitioners listening to this might use?
I think it's capable of being integrated with the two methods that you described, because it's an underlying style and approach to how people change. So it doesn't sit in competition or too strong a contrast to things like cognitive behavior therapy. However, CBT, to some extent, is delivered from an expert perspective. And in motivational interviewing, the expert's the client. So there is one area where they don't overlap well. But there's a lot of work going on in integrating CBT with motivational interviewing. And so, I rather see it as an underlying style which can be used by practitioners whenever you kind of think, uh-oh, I'm starting to try and solve this problem for the person and they're backing off. That's when the MI style could be incredibly useful.
I think that's something that people encounter on a regular basis, and the frustration that comes with that for a lot of people is demoralizing and demotivating for practitioners, and we'll definitely come on to that later on in the interview. We do, maybe let's just take a step back. Fairly obvious question here, but one that I think is perhaps relevant to some of the things that we'll be talking about. Let's go back and talk about some of the origins of motivational interviewing, where it originated, how it came about. But rather than just the sort of the usual history, I'm particularly interested in any specific moments along the way of clarity where you had an inkling, and perhaps William Miller had an inkling, that you'd come across something potentially very important.
The foundation for me, I'll tell you a story. This was before I ever heard of motivational interviewing. I was working as a nurse in an addiction treatment unit where the staff were quite sort of modern in their approach, but they had a strong view about what was best for their clients, which was to confront their denial and help them to realize they had a problem. And I was sucked into this as a young nurse until one day I was running a group for young alcoholics, and one day a notoriously resistant patient, he in the coffee rooms they would talk about him like that. He sat silently one evening through this group for young alcoholics and then walked out and shot himself and his wife in front of two little five-year-old twin girls. Now, I was 24 at the time, and have more or less spent the rest of my life trying to come to terms with how do you have a constructive conversation with people. I then moved from South Africa to the United Kingdom and noticed this in my clinical practice as a psychologist. I was trained as a psychologist, and I noticed in much less dramatic terms that whenever I gave someone, for example, a diary to fill out, they quite often didn't adhere to my best advice. And in that state of mind, there was a moment when someone called Ray Hodgson, who was my boss, who was running a little journal called Behavioral Psychotherapy at the time, came to me and said, "What do you think about this paper?" which was the original paper on MI. And it struck me straight away as, wow, this could help explain that traumatic experience that I had, which was that, you know, the more you try and push someone into the change, the more they resist, and that resistance and denial are things which don't sit as properties inside the client as much as are relational. And if you change your style, which was the basic message in this paper, if you soften your style, their resistance and denial goes down. And I think that was one moment for me, and I know for Bill Miller, it was a moment with a group of psychologists in Norway where around at that time, they were taking him through simulated role plays and asking him questions about why he did what he did. And that's when he realized, actually, if I'm soft here with a really hard problem, I get better results. And I think everything that's happened in the following 30 years has been based on that platform. Then there was another moment for me. I started teaching motivational interviewing here in the United Kingdom in the 80s, went to Australia and to do some research on a fellowship. And I was going to use brief motivational interviewing in healthcare. And on my first day, to my utter amazement, there was right next door to my new office was this bloke called Bill Miller. And so that was a rather extraordinary coincidence. And we went out for lunch. And I said to him, "Look, I'm coming here to study a brief form of this, but I feel that that paper you wrote was just too long-winded and that there were parts of it that were unclear and that you should really do a book on this." And he said, "Well, will you do it with me?" And we've been close friends ever since. So those are some moments. There are no doubt others, but I think the realization that hardness doesn't produce good outcomes was core.
And one of the things that you've mentioned there as well, paraphrasing, I suppose, and taking one of the terms from the book, is the writing reflex within there. That almost instinctive desire that we have sometimes when we see somebody who is in a less than positive space, our almost for some of us instinctive desire to want to write that situation very quickly. Let's talk about that briefly for a second, or for as long as we need, actually, because I think it's critical in terms of people's willingness to adapt and adopt motivation interviewing more into their practice. Where does that writing reflex come from, and why is it so pervasive in our work?
Yeah, I mean, why is it the writing reflex, as you say, it's a term that I came up with just to describe that inclination, see problem, solve it. And I think it comes from a good place because we've all gone into this field to try and help people. So it does come from a good place. However, I think surrounding us in care environments of all kinds is a system and a culture that tries to fix people and do things to or on them when these struggles that we're facing in the addictions field really are best dealt with them. Now, so there's a whole cultural thing there that I'm very concerned and disturbed about. But the writing reflex, I must say that initially I think I oversimplified it a little bit and thought that, hang on, motivational interviewing exists in contrast to the use of the writing reflex. But I think, you know, it is possible to use that reflex in a constructive way. I think step one is to be mindful that you're doing it.
Yeah.
You know, that's the first thing, not to use it like a reflex. Hang on, here's a situation where I really want to tell someone what I think they might do. I think that's step one. And then I think step two could involve just softening the way it's delivered. So I don't think, as I used to 10, 15 years ago, that the writing reflex is always a dysfunctional strategy. I think if you are mindful about when you're using it, and you soften your delivery of it so that you emphasize the client's autonomy, it starts approaching skillful advice giving, which I've realized over the years can actually be very MI consistent. So I don't want us to set up the writing reflex as a straw man. I think good practitioners in all settings use the writing reflex to give advice, but if they don't emphasize the autonomy of the client, then it hits trouble. And so I think there are ways of giving advice that can be really constructive. And I'm busy exploring that now in training and practice.
You mentioned in the sort of overview of some of the origins of MI, are we talking sort of 70s and 80s? What's the timescale for the original, the first edition of the book and some of the work that went into that?
First paper, 1983. First edition of the book, 1991.
Okay, so the book now is in the third edition. That was published in 2012, last year, was it?
That's correct. Yeah.
So I guess one of the things I'm particularly interested in then is, I mean, having read all three, I'm fairly familiar with it, but I'm sure the audience would be interested to know as well. What's actually changed? What's, you know, three editions of the book, so the title hasn't changed, but the content has. What, give us some flavours as, you know, what has changed inside the book?
Thanks, Matt. There's still 30 years and 3 minutes. I'll give it a go. But listen, yeah, one thing I don't want to do is to use this podcast to sell the book. So people listening, just, you know, enjoy what you hear on the podcast and see what you can put into practice. I don't want to market anything. But what is new about this new book? First of all, we decided to remove the word behavior from behavior change. And that feels very significant to us because conversations about change, not just behavior change, appear to have the same characteristics as those about behavior change in the addictions field, for example. So we broadened the tent of MI, if you like. Another change we introduced was to produce the word compassion as one of the key elements of the spirit. So that really resolves a lot of angst that we've been through about the ethics of motivational interviewing. And just with that one word, we feel we've simplified things and clarified the markers for the use of MI. In other words, if you don't feel compassion for somebody that you're talking to, MI doesn't come on the horizon. I think another difference is a greater emphasis on a strengths-based approach. And that's not something we've made explicit, but I think in keeping with quite a lot of other developments in other forms of treatment and therapy, it's quite clear that if you view a client as someone with a list of problems, MI won't get off the ground. If you view them as people with strengths and aspirations, that's a great platform for MI. So that's another change that I think is evident in the book, perhaps not in headlines, but it's there. What else, Matt? We've developed a new framework, which I can talk about in a moment, and we've also introduced the idea that MI can be used in change planning. And that is really, for me, the most exciting development of all. In other words, it used to be thought that if you, for the moment, just think about the stages of change model, it used to be thought that something like MI is best used for motivating someone in the pre-contemplation or contemplation stage. But then when you get into the preparation or action stage, MI is no longer useful. And what I'm finding really exciting at the moment is that when I study these conversations in the preparation and action stage, they're characterized by the same dynamics as those in earlier stages of change. And what we've done is suggested that very practical change planning that happens in the action stage can be done using an MI style. And that if you use the writing reflex with somebody who's ready to change, you're gonna evoke precisely the same resistance that you might in earlier stages of change. So those are some of the new developments.
Okay, if you wouldn't mind, it would be great to hear your thoughts on the framework that you mentioned there.
Yeah, you will notice from our conversation thus far that drawing out someone's own internal motivation to change has been at the heart of MI ever since it was developed. Okay, and we call that evoking. That's one word we're using for it. It's a process of evoking a different perspective for somebody about why and how they might change. That's at the heart of MI and involves evoking change talk, which is something we could talk about. But what became clear to me was that people are struggling to integrate MI into their everyday practice. We got to wonder why and whether there was something we could do that was helpful in that regard. So what we did was, this new framework consists of four words, and I've mentioned evoking and I've mentioned planning. But we've developed two other words called engage and focus that we think will help people integrate MI into practice. And perhaps, if you like, say a word or two about them.
Please do, yeah.
So we've got engage, focus, evoke, and plan. And they're like steps going up. They're not separate sequences. They're like stair steps. We can't quite find the right visual model for them because they overlap. Okay. So I don't want to present this as a sequential model. But MI won't get off the ground unless you're engaged with somebody and you've got some direction to your conversation. Okay. That's it in one sentence. Mm-hmm. But what it's led for me is to some quite profound realizations about the importance of that foundation of engaging and focusing. And perhaps I could touch a little bit on engaging.
Yeah, I think that would be particularly helpful. And in particular, how a practitioner would know that they have achieved that engagement.
Yeah, I think if a client says to you, yes, you've got me, you try and understand the client and the client says, yeah, that's right, that's how I feel. That's a signal that you're connecting with that person in something that they feel is helpful because this person understands me. So let's use that as the marker for successful preliminary engagement, okay? Mm-hmm. You can't let that engagement go when you move on, say, to MI. It's got to be maintained throughout the whole process, hence my reference to stair steps and foundation. But Matt, you know, if that's the marker, a client saying, yes, you've got me, something that distresses me hugely is the extent to which health and social care practitioners avoid engagement. And I'm truly shocked, Matt. You know, I'm a patient myself with a couple of long-term conditions, and it truly shocks me going into hospital how little attention is paid to engagement. And so I'm actually wondering now whether we're not making too much of MI. Or let me put it this way. If all counselors and practitioners could successfully get to that outcome that I described, where a client says, yes, you've got me, if engagement was widely practiced, what would the impact of that be on dropout and outcomes? And I think it would be huge. And in that sense, I feel that engagement's probably the top 80% of a triangle, if you like, with evoking, the heart of MI, just the top 20%. And I think it's an open question as to whether practitioners really need to be super hot in their MI skills, certainly not before they've got the engaging skills. And I've developed this idea more recently of rapid engagement. So Matt, when I go around training folk, I could tell you a story about what I do to demonstrate this. What I do is I say to folk, okay, so what's your average consultation length? And I get everything from 5 minutes to 50, as you can imagine, right? And I say to them, how's about following the 20% rule, in which you do nothing but engage for the first 20% of your consultation, okay? Just as a rough marker, 20%. So if you've got 50 minutes with someone, that is a remarkable amount of time, because you've got 10 minutes to engage. And that is really fantastic. And then you can move on. The logic being that you can engage a lot more rapidly than 10 minutes. And this provides a fantastic platform for anything else you want to do. So what I do is I ask them to come up with a really difficult client. And you know, as you can imagine, practitioners in and out of the addictions field, they have no difficulty with that. They
love it. Probably think of a few.
Yeah, so I draw it up on a board, and it's usually somebody pretty close to the client from hell, excuse my language, right? And so I did this last week in a job center plus of all places, you know, where really people are clients are really struggling to come to terms with changes and legislation. And the guy wouldn't even sit down, you know? I mean, he was that angry with the system that he wouldn't even shake my hand or sit down. Now, what I tried to do was rapid engagements, and I did it in about 4 or 5 minutes to the point where he said, yes, you've got me, and sat down. Now, that's taken me a lot of practice, and it's quite skillful to do, but it's very simple. And all you got to do is not do a whole lot of other things. You just got to clear your mind of a whole lot of other things you think you might do, like being clever, being rushed, taking the consultation in any direction that you think is important, but simply listen to the client and then summarize your understanding. And that's all I do. And I'm calling this rapid engagement. And I'm just finding it very stimulating at the moment. And I've been teaching people these rapid engagement skills. And I think it could help to transform care. Forget about MI.
Mm.
And what I found was that with this really tough guy last week, was that the moment I engaged him properly, the change talk, which is the heart of evoking, came tripping off his tongue. So that maybe MI isn't as difficult as we think.
I sometimes think about that engagement process and that, I suppose, rapport building, engagement, lots of different ways to describe it. I sometimes think of it as the analogy of sort of building up a bank of credit. You want to build up a bank of credit quickly, and you want to build up a significant bank of credit. Once you have that, it then allows you to spend it maybe asking a question that's a little bit too direct at the wrong time. But because you've built that bank of credit up, you're then able to spend it a little bit at a time rather than going in with those very direct questions too early on. So it gives you some leeway. I guess it gives you some leverage in terms of asking things, saying things in ways that if you didn't have it would evoke a very different response than when it's there.
That's huge. You know, I completely agree with you. And I think what practitioners mistakenly imagine is that this is wishy-washy stuff, or you're just nice to the client and you're engaging. And so I'm very clear about defining exactly what I mean here. And I can do this for you by saying that what you want to do, in addition to being genuine and nice and kind and compassionate, you want to understand the way this person is feeling. Step one. Step two, convey this understanding to them. And it's that second bit that's the skillful part, because it's not just listening is not just a matter of sitting back and understanding what someone's saying and letting it wash over you. You need to convey this understanding to them. That's what has the person saying, yes, that's right, you've got me. And that is skillful and requires us to all keep practicing listening skills. It's as simple as that.
Fantastic. Very, very helpful. Another question that I had as well off the back of that is one of the recurring themes that I encounter, particularly when I'm training or working with practitioners, is the frustration that they have towards client ambivalence to change. And when they can see clearly what's needed to be changed or fixed in the situation, but the client just isn't interested. And I suppose what you're saying there really is that the engagement process is a way to shortcut, to some extent, some of that. And it gets you on a level with a client quicker. And I suppose that would have a positive impact on the practitioner's frustration at client ambivalence.
I think so, because you've established that connection. And the biggest shift I've noticed in practitioners is that they slow down when they engage. And actually, the more you slow down, the quicker is your progress. It's quite ironic, you know. It is the case that if you just calm down yourself, Monty Roberts, that horse whisperer guy, I'm not saying like it's MI, but he says that with his horses, act like you've got all day and it'll take me 15 minutes to help a horse calm down. Act like I've got 15 minutes and it'll take all day. So I think our management of our sense of time and our composure is very important. But then I think with addiction particularly, we hit this problem of ambivalence, and it's quite a challenge, because a nice way to think about ambivalence is that people have got these voices in favor of change and in favor of staying the same in their heads at the same time. And it's quite normal for people who feel ambivalent, which was one of the starting points of motivational interviewing, to give voice to reasons why they don't want to change. It's not a pathology. It's not denial. It's just a normal part of human nature. Anything that we feel ambivalent about, we're going to give voice to the no change side. And I think if you've engaged with somebody, you're not tuning in with them and you've listened to them, so that when that, what we call sustained talk, which is the no change side of ambivalence, comes out and you're in the evoking process that I described, you just demonstrate acceptance of it. And what happens quite naturally is that the other side of it, the change talk, starts coming out. And that is the heart of evoking and motivational interviewing, because at its essence, when that change talk comes out of their mouths, you don't want to be clever. You don't want to change the subject. You don't want to speed up. What you want to do is to catch that change talk and reflect it back to them. And then more change talk will follow. And I must say, Matt, one of the most incredible developments in the field is process research. And it's most strong in the addictions field, that demonstrates that your style and your ability to listen predicts the emergence of this change talk, and that the change talk predicts better outcome. So, you know, it's a bit like watching Eric Cantona kick a football with one leg volleying for 20 minutes. It's very simple, but it takes practice and it's skillful. But it's no more complicated than what I've described, if you know what I mean.
I do. So let's focus in on then people who are listening to this, practitioners maybe on their way to work. They've had some MI training, maybe it was a long time ago, and things have sort of fallen by the wayside a little bit. What can they do? Give us, and I think that the technique, the 20% rule that you talked about for engaging, I think is very, very interesting. But somebody listening to this on the way to work, they're going to encounter some difficult clients today. What's one thing they could do differently? One thing that they could try and implement in their practice today and actually get the ball rolling in terms of that constant process of improving, so that eventually they are able to kick the ball with ease and effortlessly?
Well, I would say engage first. That's go for that and follow the 20% rule and life will be easier. I would say practice promoting client autonomy. So if you feel the writing reflex kicking in, say things like, one of the things you could do, notice the word could, the language changes. One of the things you could do is ba ba ba, but it's up to you and there might be other things you can do. Can you see that? So then I'm giving advice, but I'm promoting autonomy in the language that I use and saying things like, it's up to you. Mm-hmm. So those would be the, you know, two hot tips. Engage first, promote autonomy when you give advice, and you'll find that you will soften and they will soften and it'll be easier to make progress.
Excellent. Let's go back just briefly with a little bit of time that we've got left. Let's go back briefly and just could you go into a bit more detail about the things that practitioners should be mindful of not doing in terms of that engagement process? You gave a few before with the example from the person at the job centre. Let's just recap some of those and maybe go into a bit more detail. What are the things that people should be conscious that they are doing and ultimately hoping that they don't do?
First of all, set it up. So say to the person, what I want to do to begin with is just to understand how you feel. And then we'll talk about where else we're going to take this conversation. So you want to set it up honestly and genuinely and clearly. So set up is important. Then sit back, slow the pace of the conversation down. Clear your mind of distracting thoughts like, how much time have I got? Is this person lying to me? Why is the wife not present or whatever? Free yourself of all distracting thoughts and try and understand using open questions how they're feeling and why they've come. And then convey that back to them. That's the listening piece. The reflective listening is a statement you make. Okay, so, and then summarize your understanding at the end, however long you've given yourself. Now, what you don't do is be clever. Ask clever questions that are pointed in a particular direction that you think is important. Ask only questions that are designed to understand the way this person feels. And keep distracting thoughts out of your mind. And it's actually quite easy when you do that. I don't know if that makes sense.
Very much so. I can hear, with a practitioner hat on, I can hear people saying that that sounds all well and good, but you know, I have lots of questions to ask people. I have paperwork that I need to fill in. I need to do assessments on people. I've got all of these, and you're giving me all of these tips, but I've just not got the time.
Okay, you see, and that's like I think assessment has been, when I said to you that I was astonished at the degree to which engagement is neglected, it's because it's largely been replaced by assessment, okay? And assessment can be very useful, but I'm gobsmacked and frankly disgusted by the degree to which assessment has been allowed by managers, less so practitioners, because they tend to do what their managers want. But I'm gobsmacked by the degree to which assessment has been allowed to dominate a conversation which is actually meant to be about serving the needs of the client. So I think it's a shocker. So I'm not anti-assessment, but to begin a consultation with assessment is really, I think, poor practice and not in the interests of the needs of the client. So I would be tempted to say to those practitioners who are saying, oh, I don't have the time, I've got to ask all these questions, is be gentle with yourself and be gentle with the clients and say, right at the beginning, look, there are some questions that I need to ask you, and there's this form that I need to fill in. But I don't want to do that to begin with. I want to first understand how you feel, and then we'll talk about when I can do this assessment. And if you do engage, then people are much easier to conduct the assessment with. And indeed, a lot of your assessment questions will be answered during engagement. So that would be my answer to the practitioner who says, I don't have the time. If you've got 20, 25 minutes, that's an awful lot of time. And if you're feeling like most of your time's got to be spent answering assessment questions, then I think there's something wrong with the system. So in that sense, I'm a bit of a rebel there.
And I guess as well, you're not necessarily saying, you know, forget the assessment. Nobody would say that. But it's more the order in which the assessment takes place. The assessment, it has a place, and a perfectly good place in modern service delivery, but not necessarily before high quality engagement has taken place. And not that that needs a significant amount of time, but it's really just the order in which those two take place.
That's correct. I'm not anti-assessment, but I'm anti all consultations beginning with assessment.
Mm-hmm. Okay. This has been superb, Stephen. I really, really appreciate your time. Just before we wrap up, is there anything that maybe we haven't covered that you would have liked to have covered in the course of the interview? A question that perhaps I didn't ask, or something that you wanted to convey that maybe we haven't covered yet?
I'm just conscious of not talking about evidence. And I feel that I'm reasonably familiar with the evidence. And I think it's quite strong for motivational interviewing in the addictions field. And I would encourage practitioners not to think, oh, therefore MI is better than CBT, or MI is the way to go, which is a big mistake. I would encourage practitioners to say, hang on, the scientists have discovered something that's fairly useful here, which is that a quiet conversation about change in which the person is engaged and encouraged to give voice to their own reasons for change is a very powerful process. And in that sense, we're in a privileged position of being able to create that space for clients. And it can be done really briefly. So I just wanted to make that point about evidence.
Excellent. And that is one of the purposes of the podcast, is to translate that evidence into practice. And I think you're right. We haven't touched on it at all. And I think it's important that people are aware of some of the evidence behind motivation interviewing. And yes, it's been sort of assumed in our conversation that it's an evidence-based approach. One last question then before we wrap up. In the course of your work, you've been working in the field now for 30 years plus?
Yeah, nice. In 76 I started, man. I don't want to start counting the decades.
Can you, who in the course of your work, what ideas, maybe people or ideas, but what's changed your practice? What are some of the things that have really made a difference to the practice of Steve?
Wow, Matt, that's quite a question. I think working in the HIV field in Africa, holding children that are dying of HIV, working with practitioners who work with those children, having a long-term condition myself, has made me realize that we're all clients or patients one way or another, and that it's taught me humility. And I think humility and compassion are much stronger drivers of good practice than I used to think. So it's brought me down a peg or two, and I think it's been a very good process. I think arrogance and dogmatism are simply not called for if we're really trying to help people.
I think that's a fantastic place to end the interview. How can people find out more about you and the work that you do, Steve?
Well, I don't want to use a podcast like this to promote anything. I'd be delighted to come back some other time, Matt. It'd be fun to have an interview with other practitioners and have discussions, even arguments, I don't mind. But no, I don't want to use this as a platform for marketing. I'm sort of retiring and into sort of quieter writing life, and I do a bit of training, and people can look up my name on Google and find my website. And we do run courses in Cardiff, as do many other colleagues. And anybody can get in touch with me, and I'll advise them about where they can get training, whether it's with me or anybody else.
Thank you, Steve. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much. And thank you, everyone, for listening.
It's a pleasure on my side, too.
You've been listening to another episode of the Drug Review Podcast. Visit us online at thedrugreview.com.